Patrick Holden, I really appreciate your taking the time after a really busy conference to sit down and have a conversation with us on Farm to Table Talk. You know, a lot of people would be surprised that an international organization would be here in San Francisco hosting an event talking about the cost, true cost of American food. What brought it about?
Well, the Sustainable Food Trust is a relatively young organization which I founded having worked with the Soil Association, which is the main UK organic farming advocacy and certification body for many years. In 2011, our mission is to accelerate the transition towards more sustainable food systems, working internationally, but not trying to replicate the work that the many other organizations working all over the world in this space are already doing, but rather acting as a catalyst, bringing people who sometimes haven't worked closely together out of their silos and encouraging more systemic thinking. And I guess why San Francisco? Because maybe the short answer is because I spent a year in the Bay Area when I was at an impressionable age in 1971, because my father was a visiting professor at Stanford. The longer answer, not much longer, is that I believe that the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, the geology, the people, the fact that it's a sort of the West Coast has always been a center for the arising of new thinking, which very often permeates further east in time. And it's a wonderful place to discuss, I think, what we are on the edge of, which is a profound shift away from the old reductionist industrial food system towards a much better system in the company of many of the leaders, not just from the West Coast, but also much further afield.
Your title of the entire conference says a lot right there. When you say the true cost of American food, that implies that what we think is the cost of American food isn't, and what people are, the price that they're paying in actual money, it's different. And so you're getting at something much broader than the fact that we're only spending 12% of our disposable income on food. Could you explain that? I mean, there must have been some thought going into picking that title and feeling that there's costs that people aren't paying any attention to.
Well, it is a somewhat shocking realization, which came to me gradually, actually. The degree of the distortion of our present, the economics of our present food systems, so distorted to the point really where they are dishonest. So if you buy some food in the shops, the apparent price, whether it's cheap or expensive, is sending opposite signals to the true cost. It's really come to me quite recently a growing realization that the economics of our food systems are seriously distorted, almost to the point of dishonesty. Whereas if you want to do the right thing as a farmer, in other words, grow food which is health promoting and beneficial to the environment, you will probably make less money than if you farm in an intensive way, which is causing environmental pollution, greenhouse gases, and general damage to the environment, including the destruction of natural capital such as soil. That's the way you make money, whereas if you do all the right things, you make less money. And conversely, if you buy cheap food, the most affordable food, you're almost certainly going to be causing damage not just to the environment, but to your own health. And if you buy sustainable food, you're going to have to be well off. And how crazy is that, that the situation has come to pass where the economics are sending all the wrong messages? And the reason for that is because what economists call externalities, that means the unpriced costs or benefits which are in the backstory behind the food system, are not reflected in the price. And I realized this because I was very much involved with the development of organic standards and the promotion of the organic market back in the 80s. And the reason we did that, the pioneer organic farmers of that generation, I was young then, was because we realized we couldn't make a living unless we charged more for our food when we farmed in a sustainable way. So we attempted to put the whole thing on the premium. I've now realized that however successful the organic market is and has been, we'll reach a glass ceiling while for as long as we have to put all those internalized cost, because basically what organic farmers are doing is either avoiding the damage or having to charge more for the products because they are dealing with the problem at root. Whereas we were competing against people who were effectively avoiding the polluter pays principle. So really, the reason why we as an organization have decided to put our main attention on this true cost accounting agenda is because we feel that unless this distortion and this dishonesty is removed, we will never be able to achieve a mainstream shift towards more sustainable food production. And we need to, because the threats to the environment, to greenhouse gas and climate change, and to public health are now so serious that we're facing an ecological collapse and a public health catastrophe.
Where does government policy play into this?
Well, we've had a lot of debates about that at the conference, and Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm said this afternoon that he felt that, you know, any sort of government intervention was bound to cause trouble or, you know, not be worth claiming. But I do differ with him on that. I think that the Farm Bill and the Common Agricultural Policy in the EU has not been helping. In fact, it's been hindering until now. But that isn't to say that the principle of state intervention, where the market is not working correctly, could not be harnessed in such a way that it benefits the public interest. So let me give you an example. If the Farm Bill dollars that are currently going into subsidize in one way or another continuous corn soy production, and the food stamps and the crop insurance and all the other things that the Farm Bill is paying for, if in future any receipt of monies through the Farm Bill into the farming community were conditional upon the delivery of measurable benefits to the environment or public health, then that would send very, very different signals to farmers. And of course, the reason why that's not going to happen anytime soon is because there are huge vested interests involved, where Tom Vilsack and Obama and anybody else who's in the White House and in the administration are lobbied financially to uphold the status quo. So we need to exert a counterforce before the tax dollars that are going to subsidize the wrong kind of farming are redirected to support what we need now.
Well, what are the implications to trade? Because there are countries around the world that have more lax rules and regulations, for example, about labor, about environmental issues, and probably even about food safety. Do you see implications for the trade of food products?
I've heard that argument used many times before in governments who say, well, you know, let's say in Europe, the British government will say, well, why should we introduce taxes on damaging inputs when Johnny Foreigner, as it were, doesn't, and because they'll just take all their products and it won't be fair trade. But look what happened in Paris, the COP21 talks in December. Mm-hmm. We had international agreement on climate change because the problem was perceived to be so urgent that unless every nation acted, we'd all be frying by 2050. Now, in reality, the mess we're in with our farming systems, quite apart from the fact that they are the biggest single contributor to climate change, is such that unless we act, we are really on the edge of the abyss. And the real shocking news about this conference was the scale and extent of the impact on public health. We had this man, Tyler Norris from Kaiser Permanente, addressed us yesterday, and what he said was truly shocking.
If I'm not mistaken, he said something to the effect, for the first time, the life expectancy for our children is 5 years less than for our generation.
Yes, and he said that we're, I think, one in three, heading for one in two, people are obese in the next decade or two, and he intimated, but which was explored later in the conference, that the impact of endocrine disrupting chemicals, which are the core ingredients of pesticides, are precipitating an epidemic of cancer and other problems, diseases of the immune and nervous system, which are going to cost billions and maybe even trillions to treat over the next decades.
These are all sobering thoughts, but you also, you had people in your conference, and again, they came from all over the world to participate in this event. You had people in your conference that were giving one hope, that were identifying opportunities. I'm wondering, of all those different ideas, any of them come to mind of why you feel heartened by this and not just depressed by the fact that what we're just discussing, it, things look very bad, but what gives you the most hope and what makes you feel good about leaving this conference and looking at the challenge ahead?
What makes me feel really good, in a word, is millennials. I was a hippie once. I'm not sure whether the term hippie really works, but I was a young person who was very idealistic and believed that a change of consciousness was sweeping through the land and that it was possible to do unimaginable things that were frowned upon by our parents, including set up a rural community in West Wales after I'd been inspired by my time in the Bay Area. And ever since that time, I've never really believed that the next generation was really taking on what we started. Now I do. It's not that the millennials are the same as I was then, because, you know, they're inheriting a different memory from their parents and a different experience from the time they grew up. But the creativity, the energy, the belief that change is possible, plus the internet, I believe that the conditions are ripe for a systemic shift. And I also think that we're nearing the age of reductionist thinking, where everybody thought in mechanistic ways and acted in silos. That's giving way to something much more profound and systemic, due in part to scientific understanding in the fields of epigenetics and the human biome, which are revealing to us that actually everything is connected. And that connectedness of things, the approach needs to be applied to our new thinking about farming systems. We're going to move away from monoculture towards diversity, towards mixed farming systems which integrate livestock and crop production, rebuild soil fertility through legumes in a rotation, and rely on nature's capital and nature's intelligence to control diseases and pests rather than suppress them with a whole range of chemicals.
You know, I'm a baby boomer too, and I think you're right. I think of several of the people who are making comments that are hopeful about this millennial generation, and they want to know more about how their food is produced and what's the impact of that production. And getting those stories out gives one hope. I have to ask you this too. Yeah, one thing that's unusual about the story I've heard about you is you've got a big fan in the UK and the Prince of Wales, who's taken an interest in this whole program, and I've had the impression that you've had a relationship and conversations with the Prince of Wales about this undertaking.
Yes, I first met him in 1982, before he actually converted the farm at Highgrove to organic production. He, even then, and actually a decade before then, was interested in environmental issues, and when he had the chance to farm in his own right, he immediately wanted to put into practice his belief in what he called biologically sustainable farming. He didn't use the word organic to start with, and he investigated the systems which were being pioneered at that time, came to the conclusion he wanted to farm organically, had the very good fortune, serendipitous you could say, to encounter his farm manager, David Wilson, marvelous man, and since then I've developed a connection with him, sharing an interest in farming and other things, and so I'm lucky enough to have known him now for whatever it is.
Will you give him a report on how this conference went?
He not only gave a video message of support for the conference, but he takes a passionate interest in all these issues. He has met, and I would say, befriended many of the people who were here in one way or another over the years, and there's no doubt about it, he will be avid to know what the outcome of the conference was, because he really cares about these issues.
Well, if other people want to know more about this and see the outcome of the conference and know what your programs are and how they might get more involved, how should they get that information?
Well, they can sustainablefoodtrust.org. We've got a website. We live streamed all the conference plenary sessions, but we also recorded 16 1.5 hour long parallel sessions. They'll all be on our website as soon as we can get our act together, and we may be able to do some editing of the highlights. I think there's a fantastic library of filmed material there, which will be a conference legacy. And we've also had an offer just this afternoon of maybe looking at the possibility of turning it into a publication. But certainly to watch the parallel sessions in particular, but also the plenary sessions, and particularly if there's one plenary session I'd recommend to watch, it would be the very first one, where we had three inspirational speeches, ending with Tyler Norris from Kaiser Permanente, who really set out the scale and extent of the public health disaster which industrial farming has caused, is causing.
Would you recommend to consumers as well as farmers that they tune in and watch these?
Totally. I mean, we need to use language which is totally accessible. These issues which we've been discussing at this conference are about every citizen who eats. And, of course, as Wendell Berry observed, eating is an agricultural act. So this means that we all, as citizens, need to be worried and involved and learned about the story behind our food, because we, individually, are the cells of the bigger food system, and we have collective power if we act as an individual. And I think this is very interesting at the moment, because if you look at the internet, you look at, you know, the phenomenon of Obama getting elected because of, you know, people acting as citizens and crowdfunding and all these sort of mechanisms. Many of these changes will be brought about by the pressure of citizens acting as consumers in the marketplace or exercising their political power through various internet channels.
Well, Patrick, I want to thank you very much for being on Farm to Table Talk. I think we're fortunate to have you flying the flag of sustainability and getting people involved and bringing this program both to San Francisco and making it available to everybody. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I feel fortunate to be in touch with such inspiring leaders in the U.S. food movement. And I think it really is our collective energy which has created a wonderful atmosphere at the end of this conference.